now and then, I think it's great to have different people who are a part of our church, but not necessarily on staff, to share and to speak on a Sunday. And so you might remember over the summer, there was, I think, 4 weeks in a row where different people spoke and shared with us as the church. And I, you know, anytime we get to these weekends where I know that I'm not going to speak, so who's going to speak? Some churches like to bring in people from the outside. And as much as possible, I like people who are a part of our church and serving in our church to be the ones to come and speak. And so today we have somebody who serves with upper elementary children as a teacher, serves with middle school and high school youth on Thursday nights here with our church, and on Wednesday nights leads a small group. And this person actually, before New Harvest moved into this building, was a pastor at the church that existed in this space. And so some of you already know who I'm talking about, but would you welcome Randy Mooney?
Well, my name is Randy, but you probably know me better as Meredith's husband. So Mary and I like to go on vacation, and when we go on vacation, we'll often have a book that we're listening to on Audible. And there's been quite a few different books that we've listened to over the years. But one that we've been listening to for about 4 or 5 years now has been a series about a Wyoming game warden. Does anybody happen to know? Does that sound familiar? Am I the only one? John Doan is the only one in the entire church that has read that? Okay, Kathy Doan, of course. So we've been listening to this game warden and his exploits. He's always solving crimes or murders and different things that are going on in the entire state of Wyoming. And we thought, well, how fun would it be to actually go visit Wyoming and then be able to see all the different things that we've been reading about? And so we decided that we would rent a cheap cabin, as cheap as we can get, and then go there for about a week. So we did. We rented this cabin. It was a small one, and we were able to get it. We confirmed our price. The next day, the owner calls and said, super sorry, we're not able to give you that cabin because we already rented it out. But we have this other place that you can have. It's called the Big House, and you can have that same price. Normally, we rent out the rooms within there, but you can have the entire place to yourself, and we'll call it even. I was like, no, that's fine. Thank you. That's very generous. The house, the big house, was 8,000 or 9,000 square feet. We never rented a place like that big before. So we decided, we packed up, we were getting ready to go. We went through Washington and Idaho and Montana, finally hit Wyoming, and then went next to the middle of Wyoming, took a right, and then ended up in the middle of Wyoming, which is where this place was. And so we arrived, we got in. The lobby that you come into is basically the size of a single car garage. And so you walk in there, it's just the mudroom. That's just where you put your shoes and your coats and all that. There's a shotgun in the corner because it's Wyoming. And so you walk in there, then you come into the building itself, and it's just this kind of like semi-circle shaped environment. So you walk in, and then over on the left side, So over on the left side is like the wing of where all the bedrooms are. And up here, you see just one of the pictures. You see the kitchen. Oh, the table isn't as big as I thought it was. I said it was like 20 people. So it's like 10 people at that table, but it's still a pretty big table. Then you have this big living room, vaulted ceilings, a big mural up there. The chairs were super comfortable, leather that you can sit in for a while. And then there's this nice kitchen. It had this weird, like, kitchen sink running all the way across, not just like the one that you have where the faucet is, but it was like running water the entire time. I never could figure it out. The mayor wouldn't let me get in it to slide around either, so... So then off to the side, you continue down the hallway, and then there's like an apartment for the caretaker who they didn't have a caretaker there for a while. There's another office, a sunroom. Then you go downstairs, and there's another wing of different bedrooms and another office down there. And then they had the family room, a wet bar, a workout area, and then they even had a small theater that had like 12 seats in it. And we were just like super impressed with this. So as we're getting ready for the end of the night, Mayor's making dinner, I picked up a Lord of the Rings book. They had the trilogy all there, and I've never actually read it. I've watched the movies billions of times. But I started reading through that, and that was really fun. It was really cozy. The deck that was there, we went outside and just sat and watched the sun set, and it was beautiful. You could overlook the plains. It was just wonderful, wonderful place to be in. So we're getting ready for bed, and as we go into the bedroom, the bedroom itself was bigger than our first apartment. It's just huge. And they had like two walk-in closets, you know, bathroom and a shower area and, you know, just all the different things. And the bed itself was like bigger than any bed I've ever slept in. And I know like the biggest is like a California king. I don't even know what the size this is, but it took a bit to get into. Mayor actually had to have a little stool just to be able to step into that. But that's not saying much, I mean, because it's Mayor, right? But even I had to hop, do a little hop just to get into the bed itself. And so, you know, we're getting ready for bed. We're you know, settling down. And, you know, I get on the phone, call Mayor and wish her a good night because she's on the other side of the bed. And then, so her lights are off. I'm just reading about the hobbits and Gandalf, and I've got my lamp on. And a little bit later, it's like close to midnight, all of a sudden, the door clicks open and opens wide. Yeah. In the middle of nowhere, who's going to hear you? I knew it was the Wyoming killer coming to get me. And Joe Plickett wasn't even around to be able to save me. But in that moment, fight or flight comes in handy, and I'm a fighter. And so I'm thinking, like, okay, what can I do in this moment? I'm just thinking about all these different scenarios. Like, okay, I've got this book in my hand, and I've got this lamp that I can use. So I could throw the book at them as they come through with their axe, and then they jump down off the bed, grab the lamp, and then whack them on the head. But then what if there's two that come in the door? I'm like, I only got one book. I can't throw Meredith because she won't let me do that anymore. And so... And she's too far away anyway. So, you know, like, all these different things coming in your head as you're thinking in that moment of what you need to do to be able to resolve the situation. That's short-term fear that happens. And then, like I said, fight or flight tends to happen. You either go one way or the other, generally, in those short-term fears. But those short-term fears tend to go away after a little bit. Your body settles down, and it goes into neutral. The long-term fear is quite different. Long-term fear, when you're fearing something over and over again, continuously, then something begins to change in your body. Your body continues to be tense all the time. Your mind doesn't shut down. It's always on alert for when the next danger is going to happen. You can't get enough sleep. Your mind gets all fuzzy and weird. And these hobbit-sized issues become giants in your mind. And they take a place of residence that shouldn't ever have taken a place of residence in your mind. The prophet Isaiah talks about fear, and we're going to see this up on the screen. He says this in Isaiah chapter 8, verse 12. He says, "Do not fear what they fear, and don't dread it." This is the word of the Lord for us. Do not fear what they fear, and don't dread it. What was Isaiah talking about at that time? Isaiah was talking to the Israelites. And as they were going through, they were living their life as Israelites, but they had already suffered a civil war with each other, so that 10 tribes were becoming the northern kingdom, the two tribes in the south became the southern kingdom, and they were already at odds with each other. And God had been telling them over and over through different people that you need to shape up, or I will discipline you and take you out and let somebody else come in and then be there. So we see this happening, and they're super concerned about it. And in the context, it even says, like, they're working over the conspiracies, like, who's going to take over, which nation's going to come dominate them. And you can think about even the things that are going on within the Civil War that they had of who's going to dominate within their own nation, northern or southern Israel. And so they had all these different thoughts about what was going on. They were super scared about what the future was like. And they had more concern over what was going to happen, the possibility of these things happening, rather than listening to what God had to say in the very beginning, which is just to repent, to turn towards him during those times. But they didn't. They didn't have the right mind. They didn't have the right thinking of being able to look at God during that time. Instead, they looked towards the issues, and they looked towards those things that were coming out. Later on, we see that in Isaiah, that he talks about like Assyria coming in to take them over, and we see this, you know, quite a bit later. Assyria does come in. They come in and dominate and take over the northern tribes of Israel. They take them and then they scatter them throughout the kingdom that they had. A couple hundred years later, Babylonia came in and they took the southern kingdom and then took them, and then they didn't scatter them, but at least placed them in settlements that are concentrated. And so they at least got the chance to keep their culture together, which was, I guess, a favor towards the Israelites. But that was definitely something that would be scary, you know, have another nation come in and take you over and wipe you out and place you in some other territory. There are other things that we fear too, and there's different categories of fear. So for example, the fear of physical harm, like the top one is gonna be death. I've been at the deathbed of a lot of people, and there's a lot of times where they're at peace. Like, they know what's going to happen. They have confidence in their relationship with God. They know what's going to be there in the future. Those are good, but the ones that are more scary and sad are the ones that don't have that confidence, that don't have that relationship with God, that they don't know exactly where they're going. They start regretting their entire life. They start fearing everything that happened prior to, and they're just not even sure what's going to happen. It's super sad. There's also the fear of dying itself, where you're like, how will I end my life? Will it be long and dreadful or short and quick? There's another category of fear about losing control. And there's the fear of aging. I mean, like, I'm firmly in my 50s, and I am at the point now where most of my conversations with my peers are about ailments and how long pain lasts, and, you know, oh my, you know, like, I was in bed one time before a vacation, and I was reading a book, and I sneezed, my back went out, and then I make all kinds of noises when I get up from chairs now, like, that never happened before. And so you think about, like, aging, and that's another fear that people have, is that they're losing control of different aspects of the body. They're not as lean and trim that they were in their 20s and 30s. And so there's another aspect of losing control, those that are people that are afraid of enclosed spaces, and so they need some kind of a window nearby or a door that's open. And then there's people that are fearing crowds like this, and that might even prevent them from coming into church because it causes the anxiety within them to be there. There are some people that look at the need to have everything perfect and then in order to be able to move on. There's that fear as well. Now, another category of fear is people. Sometimes we give too much weight to what other people think about us, and so we start changing our lives to mirror what they want of us rather than the things that God has made us to be. We fear exposure to other people, so we're not going to be super honest with each other as we're living our life, and I'll just put on a nice shield that you'll only ever see the good things about me rather than the totality of who I am. Because I wouldn't want to do that, because I fear your rejection. And we get that way. We fear rejection of others. We fear what others would think about us. They reject us. They move us away. We might get embarrassed, ridiculed, and then ultimately we're maybe alone. So we stop interacting with others, and we just kind of hide. That's all part of that fear aspect as well. Underneath all these fears, there's something deeper that tends to happen. Fear is the deep human response that we feel when we recognize someone or something is greater than us. That something has the ability to affect our lives in such a way that it might not only affect the current life, but our future path that we have, that we're going for. Fear isn't just an emotion, it's a declaration. It's something that we say about something that says they have more power and more influence and more control in our life than I do or anything else does. And that's not the plan that God has. Let's look at the rest of that verse in Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 8, verse 13. The Lord Almighty is the one that you are to regard as holy. He is the one you are to fear. He is the one you are to dread. Of all the things that we should fear in the world, God should be the one that we should fear the most. And it's we think about, even just in that verse, the Lord Almighty. The Lord Almighty, in the Hebrew, the word is Yahweh Sabaoth, which means Lord of hosts or Lord of armies. And it's an idea that God is the commander of the heavenly armies that are there. And he's also the ruler over every spiritual power and authority that is there. And not that God needs their help or their backup to be able to do the things that God wants, but they're willingly giving their lives and allegiance over to God himself. He doesn't need, like, the power that they give him. He doesn't get power from them. They get power from God. And that's where we're at. And I'd love to read to you some other verses that I've found within Scripture. God's greatness is so vast that no one can fully understand it. Psalm 145. And his power is mighty, while his understanding has no limit. Psalm 147. By the word of the Lord, the heavens were made. He spoke and it came to be. He commanded it and it stood firm. Psalm 33. The Lord reigns, robed in majesty, armed with strength, establishing the world as firm and secure. Psalm 93. All greatness, power, glory, majesty, and splendor belong to the Lord, for everything in heaven and earth is his. 1 Chronicles 29. Mountains quake before him and hills melt. The earth trembles in his presence, the world and all who live in it. Nahum chapter 1. He measures water in the hollow of his hand and then marks off the heavens by the breadth of his hand. The nations are just like a drop in a bucket and dust on the scales. Isaiah chapter 40. God's dominion is eternal and his kingdom endures from generation to generation. He does as he pleases with the powers of heaven and earth, and no one can hold back his hand or question his actions. Daniel chapter 4. The Lord is exalted over all nations, his glory above the heavens. Psalm 113. He brings princes to nothing and reduces rulers of the world to emptiness. Isaiah 40. When Isaiah saw the Lord seated on a throne with his robe filling the temple, the seraphim proclaimed, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty. The whole earth is full of his glory." Isaiah chapter 6. And in Deuteronomy chapter 10, the Lord is God of gods and Lord of lords, the great God, mighty and awesome. That's just a glimpse of what God is. That's just a glimpse of what God does with the power that he has. And it's no surprise that when people come into the presence of God, the first thing is they recognize that God is completely different and he's wholly another being than we are, his creation. They recognize that. And the second response is to bow down. They recognize that he is worthy of giving my entire life over to. But there's another issue that happens too. Like when we're in sin and we come face to face in the presence of God and we realize like we have sinned against him, we don't want to come to him in that moment. It's like a little child comes and, you know, they break something and they're not going to tell dad or mom, and you know, they want to hide. That's how we do with God. And it's so funny because that's exactly what Adam and Eve did in the very beginning. They brought sin into the world, and then the first thing they did was hide. You can't hide from the one who knows everything, but we do. A couple decades ago, I committed a sin, and I thought for sure God was going to kill me, that he was going to come after me, because I knew, like, you know, raised in the church as I was, like, I knew that God was against sin. Like, I knew what would happen if I continued down the path. And I repented, of course. But I never felt like God's love and forgiveness was there for me. Not for a while. Because I was focused too much on the other side of what was happening with him. I mean, God would send people to me to love on me and show me forgiveness and, you know, help me with that. And I'd play super nice in front of everybody. I'd be like, I'm fine. But inside, I was super lonely. Those are the loneliest, darkest times of my life. And it wasn't until a few years after that Mary and I were visiting other churches, and we went to this one church I was meeting at Waldo Middle School. You probably heard about it. It was New Harvest, like almost 20 years ago. And it was during a song that we were singing, Oceans. I can't remember the name of the song. It's like an Oceans. And it's just like a phrase within there. It was one thing that God needed to speak to me. And so I just needed to hear that, and then finally I kind of got over that belief, and then I recognized and saw God for who he was. But we come into those relationships, or these relationships with God, and we realize, well, how are we supposed to not fear the things around us? But we are to fear God, but then we're also told, do not fear. And I'd like to introduce us to how words kind of act sometimes. Sometimes words have a wide variety of meanings. So we're going to go through five different words that are going to be up on the screen. The first is the word love. I love white chocolate fudge Oreo cookies. Does anybody else love? Yeah, okay. You're the ones that stole them because I couldn't find them anywhere in the stores. Thank you. I didn't have a single one this year, which is kind of really bummed. I love those things. I also love my wife, but I do not love my wife the same way that I love white chocolate-covered fudge Oreo cookie. I gave my life in commitment through a ceremony to many people, actually in this room, many years ago, but I didn't do the same for the fudge. Like, it's just different. The next word is hear. You can hear a sound like the click of a door opening or the dog barking in the middle of the night, but to be able to talk to somebody and say, I understand you, I hear you, is a totally different aspect of the word hear. Walk. physically walking, I can go for a walk and I can go by the Milner's house that are just a few blocks away and say hi to them. But that's different than the walk that I've been doing with my wife since the 80s, of living life with her. That's different. There's the concept of knowing, and we have, like, I know how to do some woodworking, and I also know how to play some board games. But that is different than the biblical intimacy of knowing your wife, which is way more fun than playing board games. And can I say that with a bunch of kids in the room? So let's just pretend that I said the biblical intimacy of knowing your wife by playing board games with her. You know, anyway, we'll stop. So then finally, the word fear. We think of the word fear, and it has a wide range of what those meanings are. It works in the same way. You can either come to one side and tremble and then hide with God, or you can go to another side that allows you to stand in awe, in reverence, and respect of something that you know is greater and worthy of that praise. It reminds me of standing on the Continental Divide, where if the water rains on the top of the mountain, and if it hits on the west side of the mountain, eventually that flows into the Pacific Ocean. But if the rain hits on the east side of the mountain, and eventually that funnels into the Atlantic Ocean. It's the same thing, you know, it's the same rain cloud, the same mountain, but it just depends on which side of the word or the mountain that it hits that finally determines the final outcome of what that is. Same thing with fear. Fear comes into place. It's the same word that we have, but it depends on which side it hits that will either lead towards terror or it leads towards awe and respect. The Apostle Peter wrote to a bunch of believers that were going through quite a bit at that time. They were being persecuted, and for their faith, they were being persecuted. And Peter's reaction to them had a couple phrases that were in that letter. One was to fear God, which is kind of what we're getting ready to talk about here. And then the second was to honor the emperor. Now, it's weird that Peter would tell these believers that were being persecuted to honor the emperor, because the emperor at the time was Nero, and he was not an incredibly nice emperor. He hated the Christians and would use fear against them to help them be discouraged and to be flattened out and even, in some cases, killed. And yet Peter is giving the encouragement to even honor the emperor in the midst of that. Now, he has a bigger picture in mind. A little bit later in chapter 3, this is what Peter says. As he hyperlinks back into the Isaiah chapter 8, and he uses the same phrase that we saw earlier in Isaiah 8. He says, "Do not fear their threats. Don't be frightened. But in your hearts, revere Christ as Lord." Back in Isaiah, we saw that Isaiah told the Israelites, Don't fear what they're fearing. Instead, turn to God. Peter is saying the same thing. Don't fear what they're fearing. Instead, turn to Christ. And then how does he reference Christ? He references Christ as the Lord. Philippians chapter 2, verse 9 through 11 says this, "Therefore God exalted him to the highest place and gave him the name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow, in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue acknowledge that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father." So Jesus is Lord above every name, every power, and every fear. But what kind of Lord is he? Is he one that has only this amazing amount of strength and viciousness that he could exhibit? Yeah, definitely he could. But he's also somebody that has all this goodness about him that makes him wholly different. So there's that tension of somebody that has all this power versus somebody that doesn't use it and then provides kindness. We see this tension in what C.S. Lewis wrote in Chronicles of Narnia, where Lucy is asking the beavers about the king lion, Aslan. Is he safe? And Mr. Beaver writes this, or he says this, "Safe? Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe, but he's good. He's the king, I tell you." Earlier I mentioned that all the things that we are to fear, we should fear God the most. But we don't have to fear him in terror or trembling. Why? Because he is a very good God that loves his people. He loves you with an incredible passion. He wants the relationship with you, not that you come to him in fear and trembling, but that you come to him like a little child comes to a father and wants that super warm embrace and then to be able to come in. He doesn't use his fierceness on your sin. Like when you come into sin, he doesn't use it for fierceness. He disciplines us for sure, but that's never to destroy us. It's only to restore us. Romans chapter 8 says this, "Therefore, there is now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus." So when you do come into those moments of sin where you're wondering, like I was decades ago, like what is God thinking about me? Does he think that you're worthless? Are you hearing from him that you are condemned? Are you hearing from him that you should not have done this, or you're worth nothing, and you know all these different things, this feelings of condemnation? If you're hearing that, you are not hearing from God in that moment. You're hearing from something other than God. God doesn't turn his viciousness and his strength towards you. So when you put all this together, we have Israel's fears, we have the early church fears, the fears that we carry ourselves. We recognize this one thing, and that fear is never truly neutral. It always has some place that it's going or something that it's pointing to that reveals what our true belief is. So God has questions for us, but the question that from God isn't, what are you fearing? The question from God is, do you truly understand who I am? Do you understand who I am and believe who I am? And so I'm telling you this like it's a spiritual truth, that when we put God into this highest mindset of who he rightfully is, all the power, all the glory, all the strength and everything, that diminishes all those little hobbits of issues that we had. Those giants become nothing. But it's because we're putting God into a proper place. So if that's true, and if knowing God more is important for us, then we need to bring out our fear into the light. So I'm going to close with this application. So there's 5 steps towards being able to do this. Up on the screen, hopefully you see that in the end, our fear is a belief issue. What we fear reveals what we believe about God. And so there's these 5 steps I want to introduce to you. Number 1, identify your fear. What is it that is causing you the most fear right now? Number 2, ask God, why am I fearing this? Allow God to help you understand what's at the core of that fear. What's going below that? Number 3, ask God to reveal his character. Who or what about God would allow you to understand that God is bigger than the issue that you have? If you're having a fear of death, surely you know that God is the author of life. There's a discongruency between those two things, but it's because God is bigger and he can overcome that fear. 4, align your belief and your behavior. So if what God says about himself is true, then what do I need to do to begin living that out? And then the 5th one is walk in that truth. Choose to live as if God is who he says he is. So what's like one little thing, one little action that you can do at least to start with to move you from the fear towards trusting in God? Today, we've talked a lot about God. We've seen his power, his majesty, his holiness, his goodness, his nearness. And that allows us to be able to respond to him. We have an opportunity. We can either respond in terror or we can respond in worship. So please stand with me as we begin worshiping about the greatness of God. Mm-hmm.